Welcome, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to The Collective Perspective, Reclaiming and Reshaping Theater, where artists from various identities, disciplines, and from across the country take a critical approach to the theater industry. If you appreciate the discussions being had on this podcast and want to support our creative activism, you can subscribe or follow us on Apple, Spotify, and all other major podcast platforms. To stay up to date with episodes, upcoming articles, and to get to know The Collective better, please like our Facebook page, The Collective Perspective, and Instagram at TCP Theater Podcast. Reviews are always welcome, and please leave comments or questions as we are likely to address them during our panel discussions on the last Monday of the month on Facebook Live, as well as posted here on the podcast that following Friday. We acknowledge that we three are on the traditional lands of the Kumeyaay and Dakota people, past and present. We honor with gratitude the land itself and the Kumeyaay and Dakota nations. And this acknowledgement does not take the place of authentic relationships with Indigenous communities, but serves as a first step in honoring the land we are on.
My name is Cambria Herrera, and my pronouns are she, her, or they, them. And I am a theater director. I was most recently based in Long Beach, California and Portland, Oregon, but I'm currently based in San Diego pursuing my MFA in directing. And I primarily direct new works and devise works. And I also do some community organizing specifically for BIPOC and queer individuals. And I'm going to pass it to my next host, Lilia, to introduce themselves.
Hi, hey everyone. I'm Lilia Hushmand, they, them. And pre-pandemic, I was doing a bunch of stuff. I was working as a choreographer, as a stage manager, a little bit of directing and a little bit of performance. And right when the pandemic hit, I was beginning my journey as an intimacy director. So right now, who knows? I guess my disciplines right now is just getting up and eating every day and trying to figure out what's next. But pass it on to you, Sophie.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sophie Payton. I use she, her pronouns. Pre-pandemic, I was a freelance director, producer, dramaturg. I'm doing some grant writing to help pay the bills and to supplement that career. Now during pandemic and throughout pandemic, I've sort of shifted a bit to focusing more on what kind of environment we want to make our theater in and we want to work in, and how do we come back to that environment? And what is the work we can do in this time during the pandemic to make sure that that's where we end up instead of going back to whatever nonsense it was before? I also, full disclosure for everyone, I have a brand new puppy in my household. You may or may not hear a couple barks and or whines from that little angel slash terror. Hopefully you will not, but it's very possible.
Thank you. I can't wait. Hopefully we do hear a little bit of puppy stuff. Thank you both for introducing yourselves and for being here and being willing to discuss community agreements with me today. This is a topic that I've been passionate about for a while now, because I feel that now more than ever, it feels very important to reconsider, as you said, Sophie, the nonsense we were doing before. What are we doing as theater artists? Why are we doing it? And especially in consideration of empowering the most often marginalized communities in theater. And first, I'd just like to check in with each of you. How are you doing at the top of this new year?
I'm doing messy. I gotta be totally honest with you all. I feel a little bit of clarity coming into this new year. I definitely feel a little bit of hope. I definitely feel and find myself like seeking and craving as much joy in as small and big ways as possible. But, you know, it's a hard time to be an artist. It's a hard time to wrap yourself up in your job and your identity as an artist with very little in the future that we can rely on. So I'm definitely feeling a little bit of sadness and heaviness with the transition. But, you know, I think as we come into the new year, it's a lot of staying present and taking things as they go and focusing on the small stuff. So I would say today I'm feeling really energized and excited to chat with the both of you and to talk about safety and to talk about our group agreements. And so I'd say I'm feeling pretty okay, pretty all right.
So I gotta be honest, I'm really struggling. And I feel like it's just kind of wading through different spaces of being like, I'm okay. I have a roof over my head. I'm really lucky. I'm able to see my older parents right now and be with them and help them. And I have food to eat and I'm in a privileged position while also navigating, like Sophie said, just the heaviness of our industry getting shut down. And there's just no way that we can transfer over to an online space in such a way that other industries have been able to, even though I'm sure that came with some struggle. I still feel like Zoom plays are trying their best, but we all can agree that I need to be in a community myself, which is why I picked theater as my art form, rather than, you know, picking a solo kind of art form, which I sometimes envy people who could just go in their room and paint and like process the world that way. I unfortunately can't. And so I'm kind of just in that space of not being able to do the thing that used to help me. That struggle wasn't so prominent because I was able to find spaces or create spaces that helped me with that struggle. So yeah, kind of going back and forth between like counting my blessings and also like, what the hell are we doing?
Yes, agreed. Thank you both for your honesty in checking in. I too am having a hard time right now. I think also just in reference to our land acknowledgement and it being so hard to connect right now, I just moved here and I have ancestry from this area, this land that has been lost just in two generations, has been lost in my family. And I was excited to move here and connect more to understanding and learning and observing of Kumeyaay traditions and the way of the land. And that has been really challenging when the only opportunities I can have, at least through school or through the resources I found so far, are online. And I am exhausted from my online time. Being in grad school means I'm on computer 24/7, and it's really been having a negative effect on my health physically and mentally. So that is definitely something I am working through, is my physical health in this past couple of months of staring at a screen all day. I am also working through that loss of what theater used to be, and also excited about the shifts that I see happening in myself. Really excited about how I'm reconsidering what theater is going to be like when we come back. And I'm also really struggling today specifically with the loss of family. I've lost a few family members to COVID, and I just, before this recording started, a conversation with my mom, hearing about another family member who's just gone into the hospital because of COVID. And I am having a really hard time processing the illness and death that really disproportionately affects Black and Brown and poor communities around the world. And I just wanted to say a little tribute that I'm holding those who are in my same place in the light, for healing and for hope for those who have loved ones they are concerned about right now. With that being said, I'm so excited to be reconsidering what we're doing in theater. Hey. The article that we are going to be discussing today is titled Reframing and Recontaining, subtitled Can We Really Ensure Safety in the Rehearsal Studio or Classroom? It was written by Julie Rada, published in May 2015 on HowlRound. While this article was written in 2015 and does have some specific language that might really specifically date itself, I am so in love with it because I found this article when I was researching community agreements for my MFA program this summer, and I was really inspired by its leading question. what are we really trying to get at when we talk about safety? Can we actually ensure safety? Isn't education and art making intended to be risky? If we are taking risks and growing, can we ever be truly safe? And these questions feel more relevant than ever now during our current pandemic, when safety is so important, when we are reconsidering everything we do and how it affects our health physically and mentally. This is such an important question. And in the article, after unpacking her experiences with academic and prison theater, Julie summarizes her understanding of safety for theater as meaning the temporary communal imaginary, the opening up of possibilities previously unimaginable, a perceived quality that we could travel individually or collectively to emotionally dark and painful places and come out the other side with our sense of self and our sense of community still intact. And I love that definition, especially for now, as I mentioned dark things that I'm going through. I think we're all experiencing dark things we're going through. And it is so important that we be able to maintain our sense of self in doing that creatively. So I wanted to open this up now to both of you to talk about your opinion of what this article explores about safety. What do we mean by safety in theater, and why do we need it?
I feel like, okay, to be completely 100% honest, the first time I read this article, I got really annoyed. And I had to like take a second and be like, why am I so annoyed with this nomenclature? And I then took a look at the date it was written, and seeing that it was in 2015, I was like, okay, that's probably why I felt like the word safety was used interchangeably with the word comfort. And I completely agree from that perspective that, you know, as storytellers, as art makers, we're not necessarily trying to guarantee a place of comfort and a place of coddling or preciousness. But I do feel like sometimes that gets used with safety a lot. And it feels like if you were doing a fight scene, you wouldn't say, you know, oh, if you feel like the dagger is coming too close to your face, that like you need to step out of your comfort zone and deal with that. You would go, okay, let's make this safe. And then how can we, in the confines of the choreography of the fighting, can we make that then the most exciting fight scene possible with tension and how it can like be portrayed to the audience and stuff like that. So I feel like that's a big thing that I even think nowadays in 2020 it gets tossed around a lot, the word safety. And I always feel like I have to begin a conversation first with like, well, what does safety, like, how are we using it in that context? If that makes sense.
Definitely. Yeah. Everyone, I think, probably has a different definition of safety. That is really important to maybe even start from there when working in theater, because especially when dealing with people of diverse backgrounds, what you need for safety could be totally different from what another person needs for safety.
Yeah, that was one of the first questions I had after reading it, was safety for who, right? And also like, why have we stopped hearing so much about quote unquote safe spaces in the past 5 or 6 years since this article came out? And I think it is sort of what you're saying, right? It's that safety is, it's not sort of this like fix all, you know, homogenous thing we can put on top of every room in the exact same way every time, right? Every space, every work environment that we're in theater should just be safe to be in, because you deserve that. And everyone deserves to feel safe and respected in their work environment. We shouldn't be cultivating separate safe spaces that shouldn't be outside of the work that we're doing or the spaces that we're in. And you reading back that quote, Cambria, about coming out the other side of those dark places with our sense of self and our sense of community still intact. That just really hits home for me. And I start to think about, you know, pre-pandemic, did I come out of my processes with a sense of self still intact? And often the answer is no. No, it is not. No, I did not. I lost something in that process. And usually something that I'm able to regain or find or bring back. I think there's something about talking about safety now in 2020 and the way that we've seen safety sort of talked about and weaponized in the past 5 or 6 years. I think specifically in the way that white women or white people in power have abused the way safety is defined or described. I also, in doing a little preparation for this article, found something that reminded me of the experience that the current administration had at Hamilton back in 2017. And our current president, soon to not be president, was claiming that theater needs to be a safe space, right? And this was when the cast of Hamilton had like a statement that they read to the vice president when he came to see the show. And just sort of how, even when it comes out of that individual's mouth in that time period, just 2 years after this article, it somehow feels like nasty to start calling it safety. And so just exactly like what you're saying, just thinking a bit about the difference between safety and comfort and what does the author actually mean when they define safety in this context?
Yes. Also, quickly, I just wanted to remind y'all, it is now 2021. That made me wanted to say that as we move forward.
That's a really good you, point yes. to remember.
No. 3 days in, I'm nowhere there.
It just feels surreal, honestly.
It just feels like 2 years of 2020. Like, it's just, like, all still the same slog.
Yes. But I am leaving that behind me. Focusing on today.
Absolutely.
That's a good call.
I wanted to take a sec to define community agreements as I understand them. I understand community agreements as a list of hopes developed by a group of people together that is a living document that can be changed throughout a time spent together. If it's developed to spend in a 2-hour workshop together and use it then, or if it's developed to be used for an entire rehearsal process, should always have the flexibility to change as needs change throughout that time. And I think it's very imperative that everyone involved actually agrees. I've been part of situations where like agreements have been established, but there isn't a formal moment for people to say yes or no, or to raise concerns or questions of things that they need changed or added or taken away for themselves. And then I think it can be a tool that can be used to fall back on when conflict arises. And I have rarely seen it used that way. And I want to use it more as a tool to return to rather than just something that feels a little like you're just checking a box by acknowledging what you want to work towards and then ignoring that because you're too busy throughout the rest of the process.
I love what you say, that there has to be an option to say yes or no. Because I don't think I've ever really had that question given to me, being like, do you agree? Now that I think about it, that's never been posed to me. It's just been like, these are our policies. It reminds me of how we need to stay flexible as makers, you know?
The flexibility hits really strong for me because I feel like the way I did community agreements pre-pandemic and the way that I would do community agreements now or post-pandemic world would not look at all the same. And I think what you're saying, Cambria, there's something really interesting about, I would agree, I've never seen the community agreements in a room actually brought back. When harm is caused or there's some sort of disturbance in the room or something that needs to be worked out or worked through. Or even, like you said, someone says no, or someone doesn't agree or doesn't uphold that later. There's a weird element of it that sort of is already becoming weirdly performative. Like it's sort of this thing, like the syllabus, it's this thing we do at the beginning, but it's like a thing we never revisit. And it sits on the wall for 3-4 weeks and then it goes in the trash when the, you know, someone cleans out the room. I think the only other thing I would say is I love your use of the word hopes, that these are hopes that we're all agreeing to. Because I feel like I've often heard them called rules, or I think, Lilia, you said policies. Like, that's often sort of the language I hear around them. And so something about sort of hope or forward thinking or like dreaming of what we want this space to be feels really awesome.
Yeah, when I researched community agreements this summer, I found that explanations coming from a transformative justice lens and a big part of transformative justice is imagining the world that we want to live in. And that's my perspective when I think about community agreements. I wanted to just speak to our core agreements we developed for this collective. They were proposed by Ana Sofia Villanueva and then developed with the group input. And we plan on continuing to have this be a living document. But the headings that we have specifically outlined so far are transparency, graciousness, communal education, accountability, embracing difference, forward thinking, have fun / be yourself, and freedom for failure. Do any of these specifically stand out to you, or any points that you guys would like to emphasize about these agreements we've developed for our collective?
Yeah, I feel like for me, the freedom for failure core really feels like, in my personal opinion, has to be the beginning for any of the other core agreements to work. Yeah, it just kind of gives permission for the rest of it to be in practice. Because if we keep trying to create better environments and better avenues of way to work, we have to keep remembering that it's in resistance to what already exists. And what already exists is capital. It's efficiency. It is efficiency over process. It is strenuous, and it is not, there's no breath in there, and failure is just not an option. So I feel like everything that talks about freedom for failure is pushing up against that ideal.
I love that, especially just naming to like failure with the agreements. That like, if you can't have freedom to have failure, even with the hopes or promises you're making to each other at the start of the process, then how do you even start? I think the ones that sort of hit really hard for me, accountability and embracing difference are really big ones. I feel like accountability is sort of this like big buzzword right now, but there's very few sort of specific definitions or like specific properties of like how it gets exercised, like in the room or in the space. So I am really grateful that it's on our list, and I'm really excited to see the ways that that takes shape and form with just different people in different situations, and how we continue to sort of specify what accountability is for us and for this collective, which would not be the same as another group or different groups of people.
Totally. Yes, I've been thinking about that a lot. I can't make a comedy that's just a comedy and a ball full of joy anymore. Like my work is going to be joyful, and it's going to be somber. It's going to be messy. And our processes are always going to be messy, and need to relieve myself of any expectation that anything's going to be clear or anything's going to be perfection at any time. But as Lilia so beautifully pointed out, something that really helps me is breath and giving space.
Another group agreement that really sticks out to me, and something that really excites me just about the conversations that we're going to continue to have over the course of this podcast, is thinking about being forward thinking. And I think we sort of tapped into that a little bit in thinking about sometimes you get hung up on just talking about the problem and talking about the thing and organizing and strategizing for it. I can relate to that being a little bit of a type A brain and really wanting to do the planning and the prep and the organization for it. But eventually you just have to do the thing. And so something that I really appreciate about our agreements is really implementing this idea of being forward thinking. We're not just going to spin our wheels about the problems. We're not just going to sit here and commiserate or be upset about the things that aren't working, but that we're really pushing forward and thinking about, what do we do about this now? We've talked about these problems for years, right? This conversation we're having now, this isn't new either. It's new for the three of us, and hopefully it's new for some of our listeners, but you know, this is not, the idea of unsafe work environments in theater is as old as theater itself. And so how do we sort of put some of these things into practice and really start thinking and moving forward, as opposed to just sort of moving around and shaking and being terrified about what's happening?
So I'm curious what you all thought specifically about this article's phrasing of supportive environment as possibly a better or clearer name for what we're actually trying to get at when we talk about safety or maybe even comfort in theater. I think supportive environment is a great word because I'm all about empowering myself and others I work with. And I wanted to know how that resonated with you all.
Yeah, because it makes me think about, you know, I don't think that it's, I think it's fair to assume that most of the work environments we'll be in, there is the presence of harm is very much there or could be there or will be there. It will happen at some point at some level of severity. And so it's more about how do we create a space to take care of that? Or like you said, prevent that harm or repair from that harm, as opposed to building environments that just assume harm won't be there, which doesn't feel realistic.
Yeah, for sure. And I feel like just even talking about the word safety, it makes me, my first question that comes up is, well, why did this become a conversation in the first place? That it's in response to something. And just thinking so much about the damage that happens because of institutions and people who are placed in institutions, such as professors trying to like get the, you know, the meaty moment out of their students, and therefore thinking that they're helping them by putting in these places that that are pushing emotional boundaries, whereas believing someone when they say, I don't feel safe. And instead of you as the person in power saying, well, I know best, just believing that person, even if you do think that they're in discomfort. Does that make any sense, what I'm saying?
It like, really does, Lilia. I feel like I'm sort of going back to the article a little bit and thinking about this one quote that's in here. Education is inherently unsafe. It's fundamentally designed to challenge one's sense of boundaries. And just to think of that even being said or written any time recently in the past year, just feels to assume very that education is unsafe. Like, no, education should be incredibly safe. In fact, it should be safer to be able to take those risks and to be able to go farther. And even the idea of professors challenging one's sense of boundaries, even just that phrasing, assumes that you have a sense of boundaries instead of just boundaries that exist that are part of you. And things, places you can go and places you can't go. And a lot of those shouldn't be challenged and don't need to be challenged. And that doesn't mean you can't grow your skill set. You can't be pushed, challenged in other ways, adapt, have new skills, but that you don't need to push your boundaries or adapt your boundaries. Some of those are just set and should be respected as such.
I think an important thing to bring up is the hierarchy innate in the structure of how most people make theater in the US and in academia, that there is so little agency for students and for performers in relationship to professors and directors and producers and sometimes even designers or stage managers. And that is something I think about a lot, is why do we have these roles? You know, in so many ways they do serve us, but in so many ways, in terms of casting and in terms of rehearsal room culture, I see that the way we operate does not serve everyone. It serves those in power. Why do we as members of intersectionally marginalized groups specifically need to prioritize safety or supportive environments? I just shared one reason for me, which is our hierarchy structure. But I'm wondering if there's anything that comes up for you guys from that question.
I mean, I think similarly, since I'm also a director and I'm often working with institutions and sort of like short-term freelance contracts, that I do sort of think about what is the culture at the institution and how, if I'm coming into the space and I'm bringing others into the space to make something and build something together over a series of weeks or months, I feel like I have a role or a responsibility to break some of that dominant culture that's present in the space. And that, it's really important in institutions that are not taking that care, that if there are people in the room, such as a director who does hold power in that space or in that hierarchy that is just inherent at the place, to be able to bring some of that safety and support into the room.
Yeah, for sure. Which I feel like is so much of the reason why we see right now, like intimacy direction becoming such a huge specialization to bring into rooms, not just in theater, but in film. And the pushback against it is immense and incredible to see. And I feel like before we talk about pushback of intimacy direction, is the reason why it's needed. And then the reason why it's needed is because we're continuing to create theater from this dominant culture, and how in the US, primarily, at least in my experience in regional theaters, which then trickles to all sorts of different spaces where people are making plays together. This hierarchy that you're talking about, Cambria, that like, where did that even come from in the first place? And then when that hierarchy was created, when did specialization become a thing? And then when that was created, why then are we now creating a role that we're trying to get into institutions to have money to pay for an intimacy director? It just feels like it's all one big rolling problem. And the nut of it is the fact that when theater and opera merged together, because theater used to be this scrappy, dirty, like it was in truck beds and you know, people are throwing tomatoes, and it was not this glamorized thing that we have now. If I pay this much to go see something, I want to be able to see my money's worth. Whereas like the idea of paying for a ticket is I'm paying for the labor that went into that show. Whereas in our society, the price of that ticket to go see a show, I want to see the value of it in the set. I want to see the value of it in like, what does value even mean? I think is the question I'm really getting at. I don't know. It just like kind of blows my mind that that's where we're at right now, is like, we're continuing to try and get more money. But for what? For the people who are making it, or for institutions that are going to be continually being like, donate to our theater. And then, you know, just thinking about seeing theater in other countries where the government subsidizes and they are able to get funding, the difference in the livelihoods of the artists that live in that country versus here.
Yeah, yes. I mean, artists are not at all respected in our culture in the United States. They're not valued as workers. They're not valued as people. Like you said, they're not valued as contributors. Their audiences are coming to buy the product, not to invest in the personnel and the artists who are involved, for sure.
It makes it really challenging to have these conversations take precedence when we're all trying to raise money all the time. It makes it hard to rethink why and how we do things when we are just trying to keep the lights on in the theater. And so this moment where everything is on hold really is a slight blessing in time to reconsider, I think. Because no one's selling tickets anyways, might as well spend time thinking about the people that we are really investing in when we're creating theater. And yes, the pushback is ridiculous. Pushback is so unnecessary when you're just talking about people's needs, but it's always there. People are always against trigger warnings, against intimacy directors. We don't have money for that. We don't have time for that. When people need to realize, if you keep pushing our people to the side and their needs to the side, eventually we won't have any artists left to continue doing the work. We're all going to be abused out of this industry. And I'd really hate to see that. I really hope that this moment is a chance for us to reconsider, how are we doing this and how can we do it better?
Yeah. And just like what Lilia said, where is our value? You know, and are we putting our value in our community? And are we putting our value in our takeaways and how we sort of grow together through that theatrical experience? Are we putting our value on the size and the extravagance of the set, you know, which is nothing against set designers and the amazing work that they do, but is our value really limited to that? Or is our value more expansive? I feel like the fact that intimacy directors are being looked to fix safety in the room feels like a huge problem. And if it helps to expand on it a little bit, I'm also thinking about sort of the role, I think about sort of what an intimacy director is supposed to do and what I understand their job to be versus what I actually experience when I hold that role as a consultant. And usually I'm just teaching consent. I'm not actually doing the role of intimacy direction. And maybe eventually you get to choreography, but usually it's just to teach consent. And that just feels it feels like you're saying sort of part of this like problem system of the machine of like, well, we'll just create another job that helps with safety then, because clearly it's not the systemic problem of the whole hierarchy of the theater. It's got to be just like this one advocate we must bring in.
That is what I am witnessing. Every intimacy coordinator that I have worked with or observed is that the bulk of the role is consent work, and then choreography comes next. I mean, there's this great resource that Intimacy Directors International has. Maybe we can link it in the show notes or something, but the pillars of intimacy direction of the five C's.
What are the five C's?
Yeah. So the first one is context, then consent, communication, choreography, and closure. And just for brief descriptions of those or definitions, context just has to do with the story. What is the story asking you to do? What is the context of the moment around the physical intimacy that may be happening? Consent, as we've talked about extensively on the podcast, intimacy direction often use the Planned Parenthood rules of consent, which is abbreviated to FRIES. Consent is always freely given, it's retractable, it's informed, it's enthusiastic, and it's specific. Communication has to do with, you know, having a common language, not using slang words, being professional in regards to how we communicate. Choreography, of course, is, I think Lilia spoke about this a little bit, sort of the minutiae of the movements, you know, move in here for three counts, turn your head this way. And then closure, of course, which is something we'll also emulate on this podcast, of some sort of ritual, some sort of shared connection that has a very clear in and out of the character moment. So those are the five C's: context, consent, communication, choreography, and closure.
Love it. Thank you. I do want to say on this topic, for those that are listening that might not be aware or have experienced why we need to focus on these issues, why these are problems that we're so concerned about, I would just like to say that I'm also a performer. And I have never been in a role where I wasn't sexualized at some point during my performance and or rehearsal experience. And that is a big realization I came to this year, and a big realization of why I totally understand the need for naming the problem, preventative care, respecting boundaries. And it just seems so challenging to bring it up to people that have never experienced what I've gone through as a queer Latinx performer without unpacking all my trauma for them. And since both of you have experience as intimacy directors and with this topic, I'm wondering what comes up for you and how you recommend defending or not defending the need for this topic, the need for consent, the need for intimacy direction when faced with someone who has no context of why it's needed.
Absolutely. And before I begin that, I want to shout out to Sarah Lozoff, who is amazing and incredible. And she's the person who inspired me to go into this field. You know, I always liken it back to fight choreography. And when did fight choreographers become necessary and required? And before then, I am sure it was the same. It was kind of the same situation as a lot of intimate scenes have always been interacted with, is like, okay, take these two swords and go over in the corner and figure it out. You know, you just leave performers up to their own devices, so then they can't actually do the work, which is mapping the events, finding out how, you know, that tension can be built and portraying it with connection. And if we just can provide a space where we can take all of these questions away from technicality and give that, what can we create together? You know, every time I've seen something that has been choreographed by an intimacy coordinator has never felt flat to me. It's never felt, I think, because that's a big, I think that's one of the main concerns and fears, is like, okay, if we're going to say, okay, tilt your head to the side, now go in on 3 seconds. It's kind of funny how I can ask you, well, how do you make that dance with when you're counting it out in your head, how can you make that dance look, you know, so joyous or so debilitating or whatever you're portraying in that moment? Why is that so hard for us as a society to accept about intimacy? And I think it comes back down to the fact that intimacy just first off isn't talked about in a consensual way.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a huge part of it. Exactly like what you're saying. We don't have a real sex education program in this country. We are not all taught about intimacy or sex or sexuality in any way that is consistent, or truthful or honest. A lot of folks have had to do that learning on their own or through experience. And that's our culture. It's a culture of secrecy. It's a culture of shame and embarrassment around sex and sexuality and intimacy. And I think that is a huge part of it. And I think that's some of maybe what the difference is. I can assume, although I was not there, that there was probably some pushback to fight directors as well. But I would assume that there'll probably be more pushback to intimacy directors because we're not comfortable with sexuality or intimacy in the way that maybe we are with violence or physical interactions in that way. I do often think of that example, Lilia, and I'm glad you brought it up, because I've sometimes had actors who, you know, maybe want to try something off the cuff or sort of improv, a moment of intimacy. And while some environments, I think that with the right boundaries, that can be okay. But it makes me sort of think about fight direction. What if someone was like, well, it'll just feel realer if I just punch him in the face, actually. Like, I just want to try that. Can we just try that? And it just sounds crazy to even have it come out of my mouth, because you would never hear that in a rehearsal, right? That's like so not okay. And no one would suggest that. And so to think about sort of the parallel to intimacy of, well, what if I just touch you wherever I want, whenever I want, and we'll figure it out. It's just like that's not right. And I think what you're saying, Cambria, about, you know, there are definitely folks who maybe are working in theater environments or in rehearsal rooms who have not experienced that kind of harm, have not experienced their boundaries being pushed or having their consent be challenged in certain ways. And I do think that fight direction is a good way to clue people into some of those similarities. But I also think that, you know, for me, and Lilia, you touched on this a little bit, is one of the big reasons that I started becoming incredibly passionate about intimacy direction, other than the fact that it was sort of this great disruptor in the rehearsal room. But I felt really passionate about the way that when you feel safe, you're able to go farther. When you know what your boundaries are, when you know what your limitations are, when you know what sort of the box of your playground is, we actually can take bolder risks and take those risks with like full excitement and joy and enthusiasm. And that to me is exciting, because I am thinking forward and feeling excited about new plays and new musicals where sexuality and sex and intimacy and physical interactions and physical closeness is portrayed in a way that feels realistic and feels complicated and feels messy and feels like what it is in our real lives. And isn't this sort of either uncomfortable, because you can sort of absorb the discomfort of the actors, which I definitely have seen on stage in certain intimacy moments, you can sort of tell maybe that wasn't choreographed and it feels uncomfortable to watch, or even that it just, every kiss you see looks the same. And that's not real. That's not realism. And so I'm sort of excited and hope that others will be excited about what intimacy direction leaves space for, which I think is just more reality in terms of intimacy and sex on stage, and how we sort of, I don't want to say archive it because that feels really formal, but how we sort of carry that forward in our culture and are able to really represent the fullness of humanity and that side of things in the way that we don't in our sort of day-to-day culture, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. If we're continually coming into a space to say, let's figure it out together and then moving forward from there, then the container won't be this thing that we have to continually fight each other about, that we can just continue to make the thing. But we have a lot of time before that can happen. Just as you said, like, it's a cultural shift. So it will take a lot of patience, a lot of listening, and a lot of, I think, investment and hope in a future that we believe will be possible. Because I find the cynicism helpful to detect the problem, but then sometimes we get caught in that and then we never stop having the conversation about how to do it, rather than let's just do it and be safe about it.
And I think that's what's so great about sort of the no but language and intimacy direction is we can try things and then just say no and then try something new. Is that if we just dive in, we know what our boundaries are, we know what our sort of container for the thing is, then we just have more options and we pivot from there. It doesn't prevent you from making a mistake or needing to pivot or needing to adapt or change. But you have to dive in. You know, as much as the yes and culture around collaboration is useful in some environments, and I think probably most useful in improv environments. When it comes to work and collaboration, right, I think there's inevitably some discomfort there when you hear the word no. And I think we need to get more comfortable with being able to just say, no, but I can do this thing, or we can change or go over here or try this thing differently or whatever it is. So yeah, it's sort of trying to also, you know, I think about it a lot in terms of actor support. I think about directors in audition rooms or in rehearsal rooms asking actors to possibly remove clothing or to have physical intimacy just on the spot without any preparation. And I think about sort of the way that it's instilled in us in our educational systems to just say, yes, and yes, I'll do whatever you want. Yes, sounds good. Yes, I can do anything. And how detrimental and scary and harmful and sometimes traumatic that can be, especially when it comes to physical intimacy. The question I had, let's see, this is a big question. How do we run towards safety and discomfort together?
My God, I feel like I could meditate on that all day. That is such a beautiful question. I feel like it's also like what I think about just all the time. And so much of it comes back down to so much of my life in this work, and my own individual work has always been looking at my relationship with fear. And I grew up as a trepidatious kid. I mean, I would hide in the clothes rack inside of a Nordstrom while my mom is shopping. And then she'll be like, okay, I'm leaving. And I'll come running out like, what? No, don't. Like, I couldn't even play. I was so scared sometimes. Or just, you know, being the kind of kid of, okay, everyone, we're in the car, put your seatbelt on, you know, that kind of thing. And so I think I was really lucky to have training that emphasized getting in touch with those parts of you. And not everyone is able to do that. And I recognize that. So I acknowledge that big blessing. And I think so much of it has to do with how we as a culture look at fear. And it is emphasized so much that it's this thing that we have to overcome. And it's this thing that we have to like kick in the face and beat its ass. And it's like a big middle finger to fear is kind of the notion. And I find a lot of marrying that safety and discomfort, those two, bringing those two together, as you said, Sophie, has a lot to do with maybe taking a view of fear as, you know, a part of us that gets to come along on the journey, and that it's this, you know, it's a friend that you take by the hand and say, okay, like jump off the cliff with me, rather than like, I'm going to, you know, tackle you down and you jump off the cliff and I'm going to triumph. It's more so getting practice at recognizing that we can have a relationship with fear rather than eradicate it from ourselves, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's super inspiring to me. Thank you. In response to that question, immediately thought about growth. And I think anyone can agree that growth is a good thing, right? But we can also all agree that there's always growing pains whenever you grow. And fear is a huge growing pain for me. Anytime I am approaching something new, even though I am someone that really celebrates diversity, there's always times when new things throw you for a loop. And it's important to hold space for that in yourself, to engage with it instead of turn away from it for the purpose of growing and for the purpose of creating a better place for yourself, for everyone you're working with as well. Thanks for that question.
Beautiful Sophie. Answers.
Great questions.
That was so great and gave me a lot to sort of think about and carry with me. So I just appreciate that from both of you. I just really love the idea of turning towards it. And I think something that I'm really taking with me is moving through discomfort with breath and just sort of turning inward. Or as you also eloquently said, either turning towards that fear or turning towards that issue. And I feel like that will hopefully, fingers crossed, maybe lead us somewhere that's feels a little bit different than how it feels now, as opposed to running away from it.
Thank you both for this amazing, insightful, growing, learning conversation we just had together. And to close, I would really love if we could each just choose one word or short phrase that we want to specifically reinforce from this conversation today.
I think my takeaway word is going to be hopes. I've been thinking a lot about hope and how I feel like it's not something that just exists in the world, but it's something that you have to make and create and tend to and continue to put effort and energy into to make sure that it's still there for you. And I just really love that description of group agreements being hopes for the room. And so I think I also am sort of taking away a little bit of the idea of intimacy direction, not fixing a lack of safety in the room. Or lack of safety at the organization or the institution or wherever the play or rehearsal may be happening. And so I'm also just sort of thinking about, you know, what is my hope then for intimacy direction? And then what is my hope for safety at institutions? And just sort of reflecting on those two.
My takeaway from this conversation is definitely the word messy, messy, messy.
Beautiful. My takeaway that I want to reinforce is no, but that was a new language for me that feels really empowering as far as setting boundaries go, as far as releasing the pressures I've put on myself to continually say yes, and not only as a performer, but as an artist trying, a young artist trying to make it in this industry, make it, whatever that means. And I also from learning that is I'm going to do more research into intimacy, coordinating, choreography, direction, and all the doors that will open up for me in the future. I'm very excited. So thank you both for introducing me to just no but and so much more today. That was great. And we got a little puppy bark in there.
Did you hear the puppy bark?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Which I wanted, since we mentioned it at the beginning.
I'd like to invite you all to the play I am directing, Town Hall by Caridad Civic. I'll be using community agreements for this process, and it is a play about how people can be in a room together and truly listen for the purpose of maybe healing ourselves or maybe even starting to heal our world. This will be showcased on Zoom February 18th to 20th, and tickets can be found at theater with an R-E. .ucsd.edu/season. For some resources on intimacy direction, as well as creating safe work environments and building core agreements for the next room that you are in and wanting to do something about it, we will have links for these following resources in the show notes. We want to shout out Intimacy Directors of Color, Intimacy Directors and Coordinators, who were formerly Intimacy Directors International, the Not in Our House Project in Chicago for Chicago Theater Standards, as well as the podcast Intimacy, Choreography, and Conversation. These are great places to go if you're looking where to start. If you want us to shout you out, if you're doing this work, please comment on our Facebook page.
For those who may be located in Minnesota or Twin Cities-based theater artists who are listening, I would highly encourage you to get involved with TALC. That's the Theater Artist Leader Coalition. We actually are drawing a lot of work in the group from the Chicago Standards. So I'm glad, Lilia, that you mentioned that. Some of the standards coming out of other cities have been incredible. This is a collection of theater makers who are working to create a better standard of working practices for technicians, performing artists, and artists of all ages. We're hoping to create a set of standards that can be used statewide across Minnesota that keeps all artists from experiencing harassment, emotional, physical, or sexual harm or discrimination, and ensuring that safe working conditions for everyone, no matter how large or small the organization is. So I'm leading one of the working groups with TALC, and I'm just feeling very passionate and excited about the work that they're doing around safety, specifically in Minnesota and for Minnesota theater. So if you're not already involved, I highly encourage you to hop on board. And if you're not local to Minnesota, you're also more than welcome to jump on. So feel free to plug in at no matter where you are.
Thanks again for tuning in. Please remember to subscribe on the platform you are currently listening to and follow us on Instagram and Facebook. Please leave a review, comment, or question to be addressed during our monthly live panel discussion on the last Monday of the month, or reach out to us via email, tcptheaterpodcasts@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to The Collective Perspective, reclaiming and reshaping theater with
Alex Reed,
Ana Sofia Villanueva,
Cambria Herrera,
Lilia Hushman,
Lupika Shaw,
Ugi Push,
Saimukda Dwampusai Vongsai,
Sequoia Hawk,
Shalana Wanch,
Sophie Payton,
Tia Jemison,
Vahishta Vafadari.